Greetings and welcome to the Science Podcast. Today, in the third and last of our audio dispatches from the 2007 AAAS annual meeting, we'll look at how evolutionary processes and mutations shape the development of cancer and the implications of those observations for cancer treatments. We'll also touch on some issues surrounding sustainable use of ocean resources and follow up on several other stories from the AAAS annual meeting with the editor of Science's free daily news site, Science Now. Stay with us. The mechanism of genetic mutation lies at the heart of both evolution and cancer, so much so that some scientists have come to view cancer itself as an evolutionary and ecological process within the body, as tumor cells react and evolve through natural selection. Some of the implications of that view were the topic of a Sunday afternoon symposium at the AAAS annual meeting in San Francisco, California. One of the session's participants, Edward Cox of Princeton University, framed the broad issue this way.
I think nowadays most people realize that cancer is a genetic disease. It's caused by mutations and instability in the genome of any animal that has cancer. And yet, with that huge instability, these cells keep plodding on and keep multiplying, and they overwhelm the host. So if you look at it from that point of view, it's very much like the evolution of a new species into a niche. The difference is that it happens very rapidly. That is, from when you first notice that there is a metastatic growth of some sort to the death of the organism is measured in a few years at most, often in a few months.
One natural question that arises from that view is whether cancer cells show a greater frequency of random mutations than normal cells, since selection for traits resulting from random mutations is a key driver of evolution. Indeed, many years ago, Lawrence Loeb of the University of Washington proposed that cancer cells exhibit a so-called mutator phenotype. That is, that cancer cells are much more likely to experience random mutations than normal cells. That qualitative proposal stemmed partly from the observation that the background mutation of normal cells seemed insufficient to account for the number of mutations seen in cancers. But it's only recently that Loeb's laboratory has been able to develop an assay that can nail down the number of random mutations in a given cell with the required sensitivity. When Loeb used the assay to compare cancer cells and normal cells, the results were startling.
We've applied the assay to looking at cancers and adjacent normal tissue on 5 tumors, and the cancer cells had more than 200 times, the frequency of random mutations than the normal adjacent cells.
That means that an individual cancer cell might have anywhere from 1,000 to 3,000 random mutations, and that the collection of cancerous cells that make up a tumor might contain billions of random mutations. That finding, if correct, could have sobering implications for the search for therapies that inhibit specific, closely targeted cancer-related genes. With billions of random mutations sloshing around in a given tumor, says Loeb,
cancer cells will contain cells that encode proteins that are mutant against any drug you ever conceive.
Instead, Loeb argues, these results seem to strongly support multi-pronged approaches like combined chemotherapy. And in the longer term, Loeb suggests that rather than searching for agents that target specific genes, a better approach would be to attempt to understand the mechanisms behind random mutations in cancer cells, and to attempt to slow those mechanisms down, thereby potentially slowing down the progress of the cancer itself. One hint toward an understanding of the mechanisms leading to mutation could come from work reported by Susan Rosenberg of Baylor College of Medicine. Rosenberg's lab has discovered that certain bacteria, when exposed to environmental stresses, will actually boost their own mutation rates.
We've been studying a process by which bacteria exposed to a starvation stress environment activate programs, stress responses, normal stress responses that they use to keep themselves alive, and exciting and unexpected consequences that apart from just putting their cells back together, they also alter their genomes. They run mutation generation programs. What this means is that when cells see stress, they can potentially accelerate their rates of evolution.
The bacteria studied in Rosenberg's lab accomplished the increased mutations through the unusual mechanism of substituting an error-prone method of repairing DNA breaks for the more reliable method they used when not under environmental stresses. Why they would do this is uncertain, but one potential explanation could be that severe environmental stresses make the organism more likely to try the inherently hazardous experiment of altering its own genome as it gropes for a response. Rosenberg's experiments dealt with E. coli bacteria, but she suggests that the bacteria could be a reasonable model for what's going on in cancer.
The proteins that work on DNA are some of the most well-conserved proteins in all of existence, probably because DNA is very well-conserved. And those very same proteins that are involved with either the prevention of mutation or the generation of mutations in bacteria like E. coli, which are wonderful organisms to work with, exist in humans. And frequently they have been shown in humans to cause similar do similar jobs. Disruption of those jobs can lead to mutation. In humans, the phenotype that's exhibited when mutation rate goes up is cancer. So the idea is that we can make progress rapidly understanding the basic molecular mechanisms of the generation of mutations in simple organisms, and then look for those same mechanisms in people. And many, many, many times this has worked. And then we find the important cancer genes and the important processes that lead to cancer.
If what's going on in E. coli does shed light on the mechanisms of mutation in cancer cells, could targeting those mechanisms lead to new anti-cancer therapies? Rosenberg suggests that pursuing such a therapeutic strategy would be complicated, but not impossible.
The bad news, unfortunately, is there is not a single mechanism by which cells accelerate mutation rate in response to stress. That's bad news because learning one does not solve the whole problem. You have to go and learn the next and the next and the next. The good news is that as many labs are starting now to work on these and find the different aspects of these mechanisms, we can start to see some common components. And the good news is there are some common components. So if one wanted to know in general terms what might be important, there's hope that we can find the things that might be generally important.
From overfishing to pollution and nutrient loading, the oceans face a variety of insults from humans, and finding more sustainable approaches toward ocean resources is a key problem for the future. Solving that problem, according to Marcia McNutt, the president and CEO of the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, will require learning the lessons of human history on the shore side and resolving the issues at the nexus between ocean and land. She explored this view in a well-attended topical lecture at the AAAS 2007 annual meeting in San Francisco. I chatted with her after the talk about some of the issues she raised. Marcia McNutt, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Stuart.
So, Dr. McNutt, I was very surprised in a talk about the ocean that you started out by talking about agriculture. And I just was curious, what is the relationship between agriculture and the oceans from a sustainability perspective?
Well, the point I was trying to make in my talk is that from the standpoint of the oceans, the agricultural revolution, which has allowed the planet to grow to 6 billion and counting, has been basically a bad thing for the ocean because it's led to eutrophication in the ocean, runoff of DDT, which has been biomagnified through the food chain, and that basically the ocean has paid the price for the Green Revolution.
Can you be a bit more specific about, aspects of the Green Revolution that have really taken a toll on the ocean?
Yes. For example, the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, which is caused by the runoff of fertilizer that comes down through the Mississippi Valley. The dead zone now has grown to the size of the state of Connecticut, and what causes blooms of phytoplankton, which grow so fast that the animals can't eat them, and therefore the plants die, they decay, they consume all the oxygen. And when they consume all the oxygen, every oxygen-breathing fish dies.
And some of these challenges from modern agriculture to the ocean are sort of unexpected and involve different kind of feedback loops in the ocean. Is that correct?
Yes. In fact, we're always finding unexpected feedback loops in the ocean. One recent example is the rise in dinoflagellates in the ocean. Dinoflagellates are a single-cell plant which haven't been found in huge numbers for 55 million years in the ocean. They are a signal which is associated with stratification, with high nutrient input, and with, frankly, large amounts of greenhouse gases. So they seem to be a signal which is kind of a global change signal, and we seem to be thinking that it might be a tipping point and there might be other surprises. That's the reason why having equipment in the ocean that allows us to see these unexpected signals is very important, because we want to know when these tipping points are crossed so that hopefully we can back off on some of the inputs and correct the inputs into the ocean when they still can be corrected.
I think one of the points you were making in your talk was that we are now moving toward a situation where, as you know, humanity is attempting to extend some of the farming and ranching of natural resources to the ocean. And one of the points that I think you were making was that there are lessons in the history of farming and ranching on land that might be applicable in the oceans. Could you go through a few of those?
Yes, one of the points is certainly the most obvious one, that we decided long ago that hunting wild populations on land was never going to feed a significant number of people and was a very inefficient use of people's time, that farming and ranching was a much more efficient way to raise food for human consumption. And yet, for the most part, more than 50% of the food we get from the sea is still from hunting wild populations. So we really need to move away from that. The wild hunting of fish in the sea really should end. The second point is that the animals we raise through ranching and farming are all herbivores. So it really makes no sense to continue to do aquaculture with carnivores.
And finally, Dr. McNutt, in moving toward a sort of a sustainable way of farming and ranching the ocean, what is the role of science? What can science do to make this happen?
Well, I think science can do a lot of things. First of all, I think people have completely underestimated how complex the ocean ecosystems are, particularly as compared to the land ecosystems, and how intertwined they are. I think it was entirely possible to put fences around a field and expect that you could sort of contain the environmental effect of whatever you did in that field. We can't put fences around an area of the ocean and ever expect to contain the ecological impact of what you do inside that, which means that until we understand better how the ecosystems of the ocean interact, anything we do anywhere in the ocean impacts everything we do anywhere in the ocean.
Marcia McNutt, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, Stuart.
Finally today, David Grimm, the editor of Science's free daily news site, Science Now, is also at the AAAS annual meeting, and he's dropped in to tell us a little bit about what Science Now is covering. David, what have you got for us?
Well, we've actually been able to cover a fair amount of stories for the meeting, which has been exciting here in San Francisco, and today I'll share three of those with you. One on more troubles having to do with diabetes. We'll talk a little bit about rising acid levels in the oceans, and finally, what tropical glaciers can tell us about climate change.
Okay, well, starting out with diabetes, I guess this is kind of focused particularly on the younger members of society.
Exactly, and it's actually about the members that actually don't even have diabetes themselves. It's children of diabetic mothers, and previous research has shown that children born of diabetic mothers tend to have cognitive problems, especially memory problems, and researchers really weren't sure why that was the case. So a team at University of California, Davis looked at some rat research, which had shown that fetuses of rats that were diabetic tended to have lower iron levels in the brain, specifically in the hippocampus, which is involved with memory. So they wanted to see if something similar was going on with humans. And what they did was they took umbilical cord blood from about 40 babies. And what they discovered is that the babies that had lower iron levels also had a lot of these cognitive defects that researchers have seen with the rats. They had problems with memory. And at the meeting, what the team presented was even 3 to 4 years out, these infants were still having these cognitive deficits. So this is really the strongest evidence yet for a mechanism for why children of diabetic mothers may have some of these memory problems that doctors are seeing.
So diabetes kind of puts these babies really, really behind in development.
Right.
How does that translate into public health measures?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think doctors are what they're saying. It even underscores more the importance of diagnosing diabetes in pregnant mothers and managing it as effectively as possible during pregnancy. And hopefully that would rain down onto the fetuses and give them a better start than they seem to have now.
Okay, well, next, something about the rising tide of acid.
Right. Well, Stuart, you may have heard the old tale that if you drop a tooth in a can of Coca-Cola, then it will dissolve overnight. And the reason that...
I've tried it many times.
Right. I've never actually tried it, but apparently it's true. And the reason...
You don't have children.
The reason it's true is because the carbon dioxide that makes your Coke fizzy also makes it acidic. And it turns out something very similar is happening in the oceans. Our team of researchers from NOAA went out and did a cruise, and they measured pH levels in the ocean. And what they found is that in the very deep ocean, there hasn't really been any changes in acidity in the past 15 years. But in the upper 700 meters, there's been a change, there's been a rise in acidity of about 0.025 pH units. And while that doesn't sound like a lot, experts say that's actually a huge change. And this is a problem especially for a lot of marine organisms that build shells, because acid levels can actually eat away these shells or prevent these shells from even forming in the first place, and it could have a lot of other broad implications for a lot of other marine organisms. So some pretty scary findings about ocean acidity here.
It seems like global warming and carbon dioxide concentrations just keep bringing new problems.
New bad news every day, and we got some, I'll talk about some more bad news in a second, but definitely in terms of acidity, we've got some bad news here. So
yeah, I mean, the theme of this meeting is sustainability, and your next story also kind of deals with issues that climate change is bringing to the fore.
Right, and this last story has to do with what glaciers can tell us about climate change, and tropical glaciers especially are very sensitive to changes in global warming, global climate change. And what researchers here from Ohio State University presented on was one of the world's largest tropical glaciers, which is called the Coriolis Glacier, which is in Peru. And what they found was they had actually looked at the glacier about 20 years ago, but because of the methods that they had back then, they were only able to take melted portions of the glacier back to the lab, and they weren't really able to do any very detailed analysis. Well, this time they were able to take solid ice cores out of the glacier and bring them back frozen on frozen trucks and do a lot of a battery of chemical tests that they weren't able to do 20 years ago. And what they found was when they cored it, this core provided a very nice archaeological record of sort of what had been happening over the past, you know, a few thousand years. And the researchers, really the most dramatic thing the researchers saw was that a lot of the periods where the recent periods where the glacier should have actually been growing, it was melting because of a warming of the earth. And what they found was that the glacier could actually disappear even within 5 years. So it's a pretty dramatic finding. And, you know, part of the umpteenth evidence and that's not only coming out of science, but out of this meeting, it just really highlighting what the impact of global climate change has been all over the world.
Well, David Grimm, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Stuart.
That wraps up this edition of the Science Podcast and also brings to a close this special series of shows from the 2007 AAAS Annual Meeting in San Francisco, California. Our podcast is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society, with additional financial support from the Golden Fund. Jeffrey Cook composed the music for the show. I'm Stuart Wills, the online editor of Science, on behalf of the journal and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Thanks for joining us.